Judge Ross, Judge Larkin, the Honorable Diane B. Ratville presiding.
Good morning. Let's all be seated. So good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the record, I will just state the date, which is June 5th, 2019. You may know that this court has got six matters on the calendar for today. Three of those matters are oral cases, and I see that we have two counsel prepared and ready at counsel table to begin. So I'll ask the marshal to call the first case. Right, and I'll just make a few quick remarks, but you can go right ahead and assume the podium. And they're really just by way of reminder. So please know that you can adjust the microphone so that it's positioned correctly. You can move that podium up and down so that it's comfortable for you. Set out your papers. Looks like you've already done that. And then before you start to speak, every time you're at the podium, if you would identify yourself so that our record is clear. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can begin.
May it please the court, my name is Rory Collins, and I represent the appellant, Ronald Bulkema. The district court erred when it denied Mr. Bulkema's motion to suppress evidence obtained as a result of a warrantless dog sniff and search of his car. The dog sniff was unlawful because it was not supported by reasonable, articulable suspicion that the police would find drugs in his car. To begin, several of the facts cited by the state to support reasonable articulable suspicion must be disregarded. Mr. Bulkema's refusal to consent to a search of his vehicle cannot be considered. The Minnesota Supreme Court has held that that is an improper consideration in the context of probable cause. That's the DD case cited in...
And it wasn't considered by the district court, right?
It was not considered by the district court. That's right, Your Honor. Second, the state's suggestion that there may have been prostitution activity in the hotel room based on the age difference between one of the women staying in the room and Mr. Bulkema is irrelevant to the question of drugs because there's nothing about prostitution activity either in itself or in the record that provides a basis to suspect that Mr. Bulkema would have drugs in his car.
And the district court, again, made a comment about prostitution activity in the evidence that was submitted, right? And as I recall, the district court expressly stated that she did not consider the prostitution activity with regards to reasonable, articulable suspicion.
That's correct, Your Honor, and the district court was correct to not consider it. And third, the fact that the car Mr. Bulkema was driving that day was a rental cannot be considered because it was not known to the officers at the time they decided to use the drug detection dog.
Why does that matter if we're looking at the case from an objective, reasonable officer's perspective?
Because although it is an objective test, it is based on the facts that were known or knowable to the officer at the time, known to the officer at the time. It can't be a post hoc justification. And so if you read the transcript, it shows that the officer and Mr. Bulkema walked out of the hotel, and then the officer asked Mr. Bulkema if he would consent to a search of his car. And as soon as Mr. Bulkema said no, if not before, but certainly as soon as he said no, then the officer said, I'm going to walk the dog around.
Well, let me ask about the facts. I thought maybe I misunderstood it. I thought that at the time the officers conducted this search or the walk around with the dog, they were already aware that this was a rental car. Is that a correct assessment of the facts or not?
I don't believe the record supports that. I think that the more natural reading of the record is that it was during the walk around that they noticed, and it was at that point that they would have an opportunity to notice it. But if there is...
And when
ambiguity.
You say that opportunity to notice it, you're obviously making an assumption about how the officer figured it out. So do you want to share that?
So the record is not, it doesn't provide a lot of specifics about what it was about the car that signaled that it was a rental. If it was they noticed the identifying badge near the windshield, or if it was something on the rear of the car. But if there's any ambiguity on this point, it must be resolved in Mr. Bulkema's favor. Because
well, and that's, I was going to go back to my other, you know, the question about the rental car. Again, this did not factor, as I read the district court's reasoning, did not factor into the district court's reasoning.
That's correct.
Which, again, you know, I appreciate how we review under the Fourth Amendment this particular issue, but it didn't factor into the district court's decision.
That's correct. As I read her ruling from the bench, she did not mention the fact that it was a rental car, that there had been testimony as to that as a basis for her ruling.
How long? I didn't see any fact-finding on the length of time that it took for Officer Heitzman to retrieve, is it Breaker, I guess, is the dog, and bring him to the car. When we look at the search dog sniff cases around cars, one of the factors is the length of time. It's to reasonableness. It's the length of time an individual is detained for the retrieving of the dog and the walk around. Does the record tell us how long it took either to get the dog, both to get the dog and then to do the walk around before the dog alerted?
The record is silent as to the length of time that process required.
But it's clear that the dog was with Officer Heitzman. It was at the scene somewhere on the grounds of the hotel.
I believe he testified that he had the dog with him. And so at the point that the officer decided to use the dog, he had seized the car. He even testified that at that point, Mr. Bolkema was not free to drive away. And so that is one trigger for why the police needed at least reasonable, articulable suspicion. Independently, the Minnesota Supreme Court has held that under our Constitution, Minnesota Constitution, reasonable, articulable suspicion is required for dog sniffs in a number of circumstances, including the exterior of a motor vehicle.
Ordinarily, those cases involve a traffic stop, and the concern about the reasonableness is how long the vehicle is stopped in traffic so that the driver and passengers can't go any further. Were you able to find a case, or which case do you believe most fits this one on the facts, where you have an unoccupied car that's parked, but you also have a driver who apparently is walking to the car, presumably to leave?
I could not find any cases involving a car without a traffic stop. Your Honor is correct that particularly the federal cases focus on whether the dog sniff extended the length in terms of time for the traffic stop. However, the Minnesota Supreme Court has taken a more restrictive view and held that a traffic stop is limited both in time and in scope. So even if it could occur within the time needed to write the ticket, it would expand the scope and it would require independent, reasonable, articulable suspicion. And that's
well, in this case, though, as far as the scope goes, the officers were investigating a drug offense. So it doesn't, this expand the scope concern is officer stops someone for a taillight and then jumps into an inquiry about drugs without any basis for it. Here, there was at least some basis for being concerned about drugs, wasn't there? That was the reason the officers were there?
Well, that was the reason the officers were there, but that doesn't supply the reasonable articulable suspicion. And the crux of the issue is that there was no nexus between the facts the officers knew what caused them to be generally suspicious and Mr. Bolkema's car.
Now, why not? I guess that's the difficult part. And it seems to be a relatively close question, but here you have a basis, don't you, for the officers to be concerned that Mr. Bolkema was a drug supplier. He's renting a hotel room and allowing drug users to use the room. And as it turns out, because he consented to a search of his person, he is a participant in drug activity of some sort. Explain why that it's not reasonable for the officer to suppose that he transports drugs in the car that he just arrived in.
Okay. So I'll start with why it's not reasonable to suspect drug transportation or trafficking or dealing. The facts that the state cites that would be relevant to that do not carry enough weight for them to reasonably reach that conclusion. So the fact that he had...
I don't mean reaching a conclusion. We're talking about reasonable suspicion, not probable cause.
And that's
pretty
right,
low standard.
But they still can't even get to reasonable suspicion based on the facts they had. So he had rented a hotel room in his own city. Again, little weight. There are many reasons why you might do that. It's not inherently unlawful. The fact that there had been prior incidents generally involving drugs at this hotel is also entitled to little weight. If you look at the case law on drug houses, for instance, the mere fact that someone is seen at or coming or going from a drug house adds little to the equation. There are cases where they had that and even prior drug convictions from the defendant and found that that was not enough. That's the Schmidt case. And the fact that there had been a party 2 days earlier does not provide a link, or there is no link to Mr. Bulkema there either. Now, first, the center of gravity of that party, so to speak, was actually in the parking lot and in a different car. It was only that one of the women found in that car where drugs were being used was staying in a hotel room that Mr. Bulkema had rented. But Mr. Bulkema was not present on that day. No one at the...
How does that help when there was consent to search on the day of the dog sniff in the hotel room, and there were drugs in the hotel room? So why doesn't that tie together all of the events that you're talking about?
Well, on the day Mr. Bulkema was arrested and he consented to the search of himself in the hotel room, there were no drugs found that day. That day they found only paraphernalia.
On Mr. Bulkema and in the room, right?
Correct. Okay. A pipe on Mr. Bulkema.
They did find drugs in the room 2 days earlier.
They did.
Again, that goes back to the scenario you were explaining of the facts related to the young woman in the parking lot who said the reason she was staying there was because Mr. Bulkema had rented the room for her.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. And now, again, the officer drew some inferences from all of these facts that you're laying out.
They did. They connected.
My reading of the district court's decision is that's what led to her conclusion.
And I agree that's what she cited as a basis for a conclusion. But it was improper to accord so much weight to the facts relating to the party, then connect them to finding the limited paraphernalia in the room on that day. Found some straws in the room and the pipe on him.
You point to the car as being the, I forgot your term, epicenter or whatever, to the case, that connects all of these circumstances. But isn't Mr. Bulkema really the centerpiece of all of this, not the car? He's the one that's connected to the people in the car. He's connected to the hotel room. He's connected, therefore, to the drugs in the hotel room. He has drugs on his person. Why isn't he the center of all of this? At least as a, I don't mean the only possible center, but why isn't he, as a matter of an officer's reasonable calculation, why isn't him being the center one of those reasonable inferences that an officer might draw?
Because the defendant is going to be one connector among all the places involved in an investigation in any case. And we can see from cases finding the nexus requirement not established that that is not enough. So, for instance, the Souto case cited in appellant's brief. There, the Minnesota Supreme Court held that there was not a nexus between the suspicious facts and the defendant's home, even though they knew that the defendant had used drugs previously as a casual user.
This is to establish probable cause, right?
That was in the context of probable cause. But as the state concedes, logically, there should also be some nexus in the reasonable suspicion context as well.
But less of a nexus when it comes to reasonable suspicion is necessary. Am I correct about that or not?
I disagree, Your Honor. Our probable cause and reasonable articulable suspicion refer to the strength of the police's suspicions and the facts they have. The nexus requirement refers to one particular type of evidence, a link. So it is not fair to say that just because we're in the context of reasonable articular suspicion here, that the nexus requirement is watered down.
But you did acknowledge, I think, in your brief that there's no case law discussing the nexus requirement in the context of reasonable articulable suspicion. Am I right about that?
That's correct, Your Honor. I believe there was one case cited by the appellee that involved reasonable articulable suspicion, but there the link was much stronger than what we have here.
So the one piece that I haven't heard you talk about yet, but maybe I missed it, and I just want to close the circle on the district court's reasoning upholding or denying the motion to suppress, which is that the officer drew some inferences from these series of things that we've talked about, and a lot of it had to do with his underlying, again, this is an officer who has been experienced in drugs and drug law enforcement and investigation for many years, that the rental of a hotel room for drug use is fairly common. And Mr. Bolcom is one of his first statements to the officer when the officer was allowed in at Mr. Bolcom's invitation to go into the room was, I'm here, I just got here 5 minutes ago, and I'm going to be leaving, I don't stay here. So the officer did draw from that, that this is a room that Mr. Bolcom is renting, and it's being used for drugs, and the drugs weren't in the room, and therefore, what's the next logical place where the drugs might be? Oh, it's where Mr. Bolcom had just exited the car. So to me, that seemed to be what was persuasive to the district court, so I'd like to hear what you want to say about that.
The problem with that, Your Honor, is that it assumes that there must be drugs on Mr. Bolcom somewhere. It treats it as a process of elimination.
Assumes that there might be, not must be. Reasonable suspicion.
Assumes that there might be, but there's nothing particularized and objective to point to indicate that there are drugs. I see that I'm out of time, Your Honor.
Let me ask one quick follow-up.
No. Go ahead, Judge Ross, and then we'll just add some time to the respondents' time. Thank you.
So a quick question I have just on the facts. It seems both everybody agrees that the hotel let your client back in the hotel room at some point after the attempt to lock him out. But I don't see in the record when it was that he went back to the hotel room. Do we know? Does the record tell us?
Yeah, so according to the record, I believe it was around noon on May 9th. The first incident occurred in the parking lot in the room on May 7th.
Right.
He went to the hotel around noon on May 9th.
That's the first time after the May 7th incident?
Yes, according to the record.
Okay.
And, of course, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, so if there's anything else you want to discuss at that point, you'll have the opportunity. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, we've added a little time to your 15 minutes to even things up here.
Thank you. May it please the court, Patrick Lofton for the State of Minnesota Assistant County Attorney. This court should affirm the district court's ruling because Detective Heinzman had reasonable articulable suspicion to conduct a drug dog sniff of appellant's car on May 9th, 2017. That suspicion was based on readily observable and objective facts and common sense inferences based on those facts and common sense inferences that would lead a prudent officer to connect what the drug activity that had been observed was to the appellant's vehicle. I've kind of gone through those facts one by one in my brief. I can do that here now, or I can address certain questions that you have, however you want to proceed.
You heard the argument of the appellant, and of course they started out by pointing out three things that are argued by you in your brief, but they are not even factors in the district court's analysis.
Right.
I appreciate that we review these things fresh on appeal, at least as to the constitutionality of the search. But do we need to even look at the prostitution activity, the defendant's refusal to allow the search or the rental in order to reach the conclusion you want us to reach, which is to affirm the denial.
You don't, Your Honor. And I'll start backwards with that, with the consent. When I put that in the brief, to use a colloquialism, it was more like icing on the cake. This court and the Minnesota Supreme Court have recognized that lack of consent on its own shouldn't be considered in the context of probable cause, that is the Deedy case. I've never seen a case that says it can't be considered for reasonable suspicion, but I think the plain language of Royer and Bostick, the United States Supreme Court cases on that, make it clear that it can be considered as one factor above many, and that's that without more phrase that I've highlighted in my brief from that. But to your point, Judge Bratvold, you could X that out and still reach the same conclusion, I do believe.
Speaking of Xing things out, I had a difficult time seeing, connecting the dots with your prostitution argument to
sure.
the officer's decision. It doesn't seem to be a very compelling basis. It doesn't seem to be the basis of the officer's activity or processing, and it doesn't seem very intuitive to me that there's a connection. Can you elaborate?
Absolutely. I'll elaborate on that twofold, both how there was evidence of prostitution and then the sort of follow-up to that relates to drugs. And I guess I'll start with that because that's just a simple, I believe, common sense fact that people know in the world that prostitution is commonly associated with drugs. So the evidence of prostitution...
When you say common sense in the world, don't we need... I don't know where we get that common sense in the world if there's no testimony to that connection.
Well, there was testimony from Detective Heinzman that it was a frequent site for narcotics activity, and then that combined with the questioning about the woman 34 years younger than appellant, along with the other two women at the hotel, he did testify that that made the connection with prostitution with them. He said he's been trained in hotel, motel interdiction, places that commonly
have... There was no questioning that I saw in the omnibus hearing and no answer by the officer that linked the potential prostitution activity in this room to drug activity. I mean, the officer himself, I didn't see any direct statement by the officer linking the two things. It was just sort of one of a series of things that he rattled off about hotel room rentals. So
correct. There is no direct testimony in the record that you can always connect prostitution to drugs. I think
not always, ever. I mean, besides we could cite the loft in common sense reference, but I don't know that that's going to carry much authority in the opinion.
It certainly wouldn't, Your Honor. But respectfully, I do submit to this court that it can consider drugs are related to prostitution.
I understand sure. that's not an illegitimate argument, except for the fact that there's nothing in the record. Don't we need evidence in the record that a police officer in these officers' shoes would have connected those dots, would have some basis to connect those dots, or any officer?
Well, I think to that point, Your Honor, I don't think you need testimony to that when you're looking at what an objective officer could assume. I think to that point, if we needed objective testimony that an officer can assume prostitution with drugs, then you need objective testimony that an officer can assume that what is on someone's person was once in their car. I think that's another inference that this court or a fact finder in the district court could make.
It seems to be, there's a physical connection, a physics reality that if you have something on your person and you just left your car,
right.
Assumptions can be made, a common person can make those assumptions without any knowledge of criminal activity. I don't know how common the assumption that you're asking us to make actually is, whether it's sufficient.
Okay.
But you may have stronger arguments you want to get to and not be peppered with questions.
Well, I don't want to spend too much time on that because, again, to Judge Bratvold's question, I think you can X it out and still get the same result. But one last thing I will say about prostitution here, I think, is the fact that you had the three women. One of those women had been in the vehicle on May 7th where other drugs were found. And to me, this suggests to a logic...
In the vehicle, not this vehicle.
I'm sorry. The vehicle, the prior vehicle on May 7th, not defendant's, not appellant's vehicle. And to me, that indicates to a logical fact finder some coming and going from this hotel room. Whether those two men in that car were staying there, we don't know. That's not in the record. But they were certainly associated in a vehicle with a woman who was staying there.
Again, we don't have any inferences from the officers who conducted the search along the lines of what you just described, right? There's no testimony.
There is no testimony.
Yeah, okay.
And I want to track your argument. Are you suggesting that because these people were found in a car 2 days before this incident, you can infer that they might be in a different car, and this might be the car that they might have been in coming and going from the hotel, and therefore there may be drugs in the car?
If I understand your question, yes. I think I understand. I'm not sure if I understand.
So because they were in that, so any car, really?
That is associated with the room when there is evidence of drug activity in the room, yes.
Okay. Well, what about the car rental? Can you speak to, is there testimony in the record indicating when the officers became aware that the car was a rental car in relation to the decision to search?
So I would point the court in that regard to page 28 through 30 of the record. The state's position is that the record doesn't indicate what appellant says it indicates in his brief.
Quote the best language from that reference that supports the idea that the officers were aware that this was a rental car before they searched.
Sure.
So to just give you a little assist, given the short amount of time, on page 29, I think, around line 10, 11, 12, those are the first references,
right?
I see to rental car.
Thank you. I took my narcotics canine, who I had with me, and ran him by several cars, including the suspect car, which was the blue sedan, I assume it was. I apologize, I don't remember what it was. And it was a rental car, and my breaker, the K9, indicated on, I believe, the driver's side door seam. So you noted it was a rental car. Did that strike you as unusual? And then he explains why. And then later, the prosecutor asks, so before we talked about, you noted that breaker, your K9 alerted on the driver's side door seam of the vehicle. I'm on page 30 now, line 14 through 16. When you say alerted, what does that mean? I think that can be read as the officer saying, oh, by the way, I had noticed this was a rental car. But I have another point about that I'd really like to make.
He doesn't say, the officer's testimony does not say when he noticed.
It does not.
Which is, I think, the point that appellant is making and what Judge Ross was
certainly
looking for. We just don't have it in the record.
I concede it's not clear. I do think that you can infer he knew it was before, but I don't think it matters. And to that point, Judge Ross, you brought this up about the objective analysis of an officer. That's what we do in these situations. We look at what a reasonable officer could have known, not what the subjective officer did know. And the language quoted in appellant's brief to this fact, he quotes Didi, which says, only the first four facts on which the district court relied were appropriate for consideration because the other two facts did not yet exist when Didi was seized, did not yet exist, were not yet known to the officer. And in Didi, I believe they're talking about furtive movements or statements that happened after a seizure, whereas here, the fact that it was a rental car did exist at the time that the drug dog was employed.
Well, when I asked my question, I was focused on my colloquy with your opponent about the idea that even if this particular officer didn't connect the dots between a rental car, a reasonable officer would have connected those dots, but that assumes the awareness that this is a rental car. So I'm not sure that, I don't know of a case that supports your suggestion that a reasonable officer would know this is a rental car.
Oh, no,
before the search.
I'm not saying a reasonable officer would. I'm saying, I guess I'm confused by your question.
Well, you're saying the fact that this was a rental car existed.
Yes.
This was a fact. And therefore, because it's a fact, a reasonable officer...
Oh, I see what you're saying. A reasonable officer would have to know it.
Right.
Yes. I think that rental cars are pretty conspicuous. They have typically a tag in the back that says it. So, yes. And I think that would...
Again, that's not in the record. I asked Appellant's counsel the same thing. We're all making assumptions about how this officer figured out that it was a rental vehicle, but none of that is brought out in the record.
I agree with you. There's no direct statement.
When you say there's a tag in the back, you mean identifying the rental company?
Typically on the license. I mean, again, I am, to Judge Bratvold's point, just talking about in the world, not in the record. But, yes, I think rental cars are typically quite conspicuous as such.
But not every time.
Not every time.
Not all rental cars are. So it would matter That may be a sticking point in your argument. I don't know that we can make that assumption, or that an officer would make the assumption, because we don't know the facts observable on the car that a reasonable from which a reasonable officer might draw this inference that you're saying is
understood.
Common knowledge.
Well, then to circle back, then you can X out those facts, and I think still affirm the district court's order here. And there's one other. Sorry, were you about to?
All right.
There's one other point, Judge Ross, you brought up that I would like to address, and it's, I believe, the Wiegand case, the sort of seminal cases about dog sniffs with cars. Minnesota law holds that the sniff of a car by a dog is not a search. It does require reasonable suspicion, but it's not a search. And the reason it requires reasonable suspicion is because a seizure is inherent in that. And as Judge Ross brought up, that's because 9 out of 10 of these cases, in fact, all of them that I could find except for the one unpublished, involve a traffic stop of some kind.
That's an interesting point. But Wiegand was decided before a number of other cases the Supreme Court decided, storage lockers, hotel or apartment hallways, where they're interesting cases, especially the storage locker case, because it seems to hinge on the fact that it could be someone inside the storage locker, so
right.
Maybe occupied. But there would be no detention of someone inside if you're walking the dog around. It seems like the Supreme Court's not necessarily precise on the question, and maybe treating these sniffs now as a search. Can you comment on that?
I certainly can. In Carter, which is the storage locker case, I cited it in my brief. I can't tell you the exact page right now. They talk about the difference between a storage locker and a car, the inherent privacy in a stationary place where you store items versus a mobile nexus, essentially, on the road where you do have less privacy, recognized back in Acevedo in the 60s and 70s by the United States Supreme Court. It's a different type of interest. And that's why in Wiegand, which I think still holds true, the Supreme Court said you got to have reasonable suspicion, but it's because you're detaining. It's because of a seizure, not because of a search.
Well, two things I'll ask about that. In this case, unlike a circumstance where the officer just may have walked Breaker around the parking lot, in this case, Mr. Bulkema was in fact detained and not allowed to leave in his car. So it seems either way it would fit the Wiegand scenario that he's being detained in order to conduct this search. So one way or the other, it seems that you still have to have this reasonable suspicion.
Agreed. I do agree with that, Your Honor. You do have to have the reasonable suspicion, but I do think it's interesting to note that Detective Heinzman could have said to Mr. Bulkema in the hotel room, okay, I found your crack pipe, I'll see you later, walked outside and sniffed the car, leaving Mr. Bulkema in the room. And I think that what that goes to is the level of the privacy.
Now, when you say the officer could have done that, I'll ask you the same question I asked your opponent, which is, were you able to find a case that's analogous to this one where the sniff under the Minnesota Constitution is on an unoccupied parked vehicle as opposed to a vehicle in traffic?
I was not, Your Honor. I think the closest thing to help with that analysis would be Cripps. I don't have the site right offhand, but it's CRIPPS, Minnesota Supreme Court, talking about, you know, an officer walking up to something itself is not a seizure. Mm-hmm. But I do think that for purposes of this court's opinion and the analysis here, reasonable suspicion does have to be found. And we do automatically get to that. I just think it's interesting when you're looking at the privacy interests here and the reasonableness of the officer's conduct that he could have walked outside and done that. But
perhaps. You don't have a case on it.
Correct. I just think under Wiegand that's apparent.
So before your time finishes, I want to make sure you get to the final issue that the appellant argued, which is the lack, in his view, of nexus between the defendant, drugs, and the vehicle. So
sure. And if Your Honor is referring to the facts that connect what was observed to the car, the primary things I would point to are there is a crack pipe on appellant's person. It's logical to assume that where there is a pipe, there are drugs to smoke it. If those drugs aren't on appellant, they're likely in his car. It's important to note with that fact that he had arrived 5 to 10 minutes earlier, according to him. So it's not a matter of he's been
there. So you left out the room. In that, I'm sorry? In your statement right there, you left out the room. You said that the drugs aren't on him, they're likely to be in the car. So now you've taken me, say, to a parking lot where, for whatever reason, the officers learn that someone has just left a vehicle and they're able to search him, find a crack pipe, and then they can immediately go into the car as well? Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm not suggesting that.
I'm a little confused.
Although,
or use a dog sniff anyway.
And my time's up, I assume I can
answer.
Go ahead. So I'm not suggesting that, although State versus Bigelow says that where you find drugs or drug paraphernalia, cops are constitutionally permitted to assume you will find more. Mm-hmm. And I think being just outside of a car is no different than seeing it right inside of a car. But to Judge Bratvold, to your point, yes, I was going to get to room 345 next. The fact that there was narcotics in the room 2 days prior, there's no testimony to this, but it's two different officers. I think we can assume it is additional paraphernalia found the second time and not the same paraphernalia, which suggests things are still freshly coming to that room that are contraband. And appellant is the renter of that hotel room. The way he got to that hotel room, both on May 7th to rent the room, if that indeed is when it was rented, and May 9th, is via a vehicle. And if he is aware of what's going on in that room, which I think you can permissibly assume as the renter of the room, the way he facilitates any of those illicit activities, it by contraband, would be through his car.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And I'll ask the marshal to give you some additional time. Appellant, if you want it, obviously your rebuttal time is yours, and you can use it as much of it as you want until the bell rings. So.
Thank you, Your Honor. Rory Collins on behalf of the appellant. 2 points that I'd like to make in rebuttal. First, the pipe is not sufficient to establish reasonable suspicion to sniff the car. And the reason is where the state goes wrong is it's not reasonable to assume that because they found a pipe on him but no drugs on him, then there might be drugs in the car. And you can look at the Souto case that we were talking about earlier. There, the police knew that the defendant had used drugs previously, and they had intercepted a package that contained drugs that was addressed to her but not delivered. And the Minnesota Supreme Court said, because you never had anything you could point to actually place drugs or reasonably suspect drugs in the house to be searched, you have not satisfied the nexus requirement.
What does it take for reasonable suspicion? What minimal circumstances would be necessary to transform a traffic stop for an equipment violation, say, to a request for consent to search a vehicle?
Well, for example, if the officer detected an odor of drugs or observed signs that the driver was under the influence of drugs. And, of course, neither of those
that would pretty much get you probable cause. I'm just talking about reasonable suspicion to make the request. Can I walk around your car with my drug-sniffing dog? Do you consent to that? It doesn't take much, so I'm wondering what you think is a minimal. Are you saying the officer has to smell drugs or observe drugs in the car in order to get reasonable suspicion, simply to ask for consent?
I think those examples would. To give Your Honor another example from a case, the Lugo case from the Minnesota Supreme Court was a traffic stop, and they found reasonable suspicion to then do a drug dog sniff based on a combination of knowing that the driver had recently been arrested for drugs, that he had just been seen entering and leaving a drug house that was currently under surveillance, that he told the officer during the stop, "Just take me to jail." That was a quote. And that he had been slow to stop for the officer, and he was seen reaching over his seat as if hiding something. So I think short of actual detection of symptoms or signs of drug use, like intoxication or an odor, you'd need a number of factors like that to get there.
What if the driver just said, out of the blue in a traffic stop, "I use drugs once in a while"? Would the officer be allowed to ask the driver in that circumstance, do you mind? Would you consent to a walk around with the drug dog? I've got him right back here in my car.
No, Your Honor, because the statement, "I use drugs once in a while," doesn't support a reasonable basis to assume that it has been recent or that there would be anything in the car that day. So I think you would need to hear more along those lines.
All you're asking for is a consent. You're asking the individual if he'll agree to it. I'm just not sure there's much of a... I get the impression there's not much. There has to be some rational basis. I mean, going back to Terry, I mean, versus Ohio, where all of this case law began, you've got someone just walking in front of a department store. And the officer said, "I'm not sure exactly what drew my attention." But then there's suspicion about maybe they're casing the joint. And that's all there was for reasonable suspicion. It doesn't take much. My concern is that your argument is touching on issues that would... circumstances that would get to probable cause. So address that concern.
Okay, well, that goes to the second point I wanted to make, which is if you compare the facts of this case to the Minnesota Supreme Court's dog sniff cases to date, it is more similar to the two cases where the Minnesota Supreme Court has found that reasonable suspicion was not satisfied than it is for the cases where it has. So where reasonable suspicion was not satisfied was Carter, that's the storage unit case, where they had seen a car linked to the defendant scouting the police station there. They knew from the management that defendant and his brother each rented two units and sometimes visited multiple times a day, which was unusual, and they recognized defendant's brother from a previous drug investigation. All of that was suspicious, but it didn't lead to a reasonable suspicion that there would be drugs in the unit that day. And the other case where...
In the unit of the defendant. Wasn't that the key missing problem in Carter, is that the evidence, facts that led them to suspect drug use related to the defendant's brother, not to the defendant?
That was one of the issues, correct, Your Honor. But here we have a similar... A parallel circumstance, because a lot of the facts do not relate directly to Mr. Bolkema, but
to crack
people.
Pipe does, and this room certainly does, and a lot happened in the room.
A lot happened in the room, but there's nothing in the record to show that he knew what had happened or that he had been involved in any way.
And that, I guess, that then circles back nicely to what Judge Ross said, because if they were required to give evidence of the defendant's subjective awareness, that would change the analysis considerably, right? That's not the same as reasonable articulable suspicion. So are you really arguing to the standard that we have to apply in this case?
Yes, and I see that I'm out of time. I just answer
sure,
this
question.
Sure,
why don't you give one quick sum-up answer? We appreciate it. Thank you.
So to hone in on the standard here, if you contrast facts of this case in Carter and Wiegand to the cases where the Minnesota Supreme Court found reasonable articulable suspicion, all of those cases had much stronger facts suggesting that they would find drugs in the place to be sniffed on that day. So in Davis, the apartment management had seen grow lights in the apartment, and the defendant wouldn't let them enter to fix a water leak. In Edstrom, they had a corroborated tip that the defendant was dealing out of his apartment. And in Lugo, which we discussed earlier during the rebuttal, they had a long list of factors, including defendant's recent drug arrest, said, "Take me to jail," and that he had just been seen entering and leaving a drug house under surveillance. So for all the reasons we've discussed, I urge the court to reverse the denial of the motion to suppress and vacate Mr. Bolkema's conviction. Thank you.
Our thanks to counsel. This matter is now submitted to the court for its decision. We will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you. So while counsel are changing places at the table, I'll ask the marshal to call the